This is the Parliament Hillbillies, episode 1 for February 20th, 2006.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know what the honourable member has been smoking or taking. The fact is...
Welcome to the Parliament Hillbillies, your podcast for Canadian politics. I'm Alex.
And I'm Jeremy. You can check us out online at our blog at phbo.blogspot.com. That's PHBO is in Parliament Hillbillies, Ottawa. If you have any comments about today's show, you can post them on our blog, or you can send us an email. The link is listed on the page.
Well, today on the show, we're going to be talking about Gordon O'Connor, the new defense minister, also taking a look at Canada's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Wilson. Also, the CBC, privatization on the horizon, and finally, ending off with some more discussion on the cartoon controversy.
But before we dig into the issues, being that this is the first official episode of the Parliament Hillbillies, we'd like to give you an idea of what you can expect from our podcast.
Throughout this series, we'll bring the fun world of politics into the mainstream through weekly commentary on things like question period, legislation, house votes, and other political happenings on the Hill. But don't forget the scandals, floor crossings, and parliamentary brawls to spice things up.
Seeing as Parliament doesn't actually start until April officially, in the meantime, we'll be looking at other current events pertaining to politics.
But I want to start off by congratulating the Olympic women's hockey team. Currently, they're in the first period of the gold medal game against Sweden, and they're up 2-0. So we're all very proud of them. They're the pride and joy of Canadian athletes and of our country. I want to make a comment about some of the criticism that they've received over the Olympics regarding running up the scores. Some people have been saying that it's not in a sportsmanlike manner or conduct to be, you know, in a game that's already, you know, decidedly a win, to jack up the score, you know, to ridiculous levels. I think the original game with Italy was something like 15-0. I think that these people have to understand that the rules of the Olympic hockey are different than the rules of the NHL. Don Cherry's argument of don't run up the score, you know, to prevent incidents like the Todd Bertuzzi, you know, Steve Moore hit back in 2004, they just don't apply in an Olympic setting. You have a rule that says that goal differentials make the difference in tie situations. So it's really the onus is on the team to try to do as good as they possibly can. And anybody that is, you know, critical of how successful they've been, I think just does not understand the rules. Now, I've heard arguments saying, well, you know, Canada, you know, they know that they're going to win and they know they're going to the gold medal game, so they shouldn't, you know, do this. But I think there was a guy on Global, and he was saying, well, Canada and U.S. are both the two teams that know that they're going to the gold medal game, so they shouldn't be running up the scores. Well, in the end, we saw that that didn't happen. The U.S., you know, won bronze, but they didn't make it to the final round. Upsets happen, you know, in Olympic hockey or any hockey game. So if you were to, for 1 minute, take your win for granted before it's actually happened, that's just not, the way to try to compete in a game, especially a world, you know, setting like the Olympics. So, you know, congratulations to the women's hockey team. You've done a fantastic job, and full praise from us.
Yeah, and upsets are certainly something that the men's team know a little bit about, but
yes,
good luck to the women's team. And
good luck to the men's team, for that matter.
Yeah, for that matter, too. And we'll maybe give you an update on the score, even though you probably know how it's concluded at the end of the show. In the meantime, one thing that I want to look at, and this is without a sense of irony, is I want to talk about why we don't have anything to talk about. It seems that the media is still fixated on some of the things that we're talking about in last week's episode, namely the cabinet appointments, David Emerson, Michael Forte. I thought maybe just to start off, you could maybe, Alex, give a recap, 30 seconds, what your take is on Forte and Emerson.
Well, I think that the media has really, you know, done a good job of blowing the whole thing out of proportion. You know, we won't really have to get into the history there because we covered that in the last episode. But, you know, since the last episode, I don't think that really it's done anything. So the media has sort of, you know, continued to pound the case. I think that it's a tired story. Emerson has come out defiant to his critics, saying, you know, I'm going to stay just right where I am. And so I really think that if you want to keep publishing stories about this, you're just going to lose people's interest.
Right. I think the main idea here is that, well, my take on it anyway is that voters were probably more cynical of the Liberal Party in the last election than the Conservatives. And I think in the next election, as a result of this issue, I think voters will be equally cynical of both parties. And that's an issue, of course, that the media doesn't have to play out. But one thing that one criticism maybe of the Conservative government is that they haven't really given the media anything else to talk about. We saw during the campaign that they actually had a pretty brilliant plan when it came to handling the media. And one thing about being a modern political party is being able to handle the media, being able to control the headlines on a daily basis. And one reason I think that they're still fixated on these issues, especially with Emerson, is that there simply isn't anything else to talk about. And the Conservatives had a prime opportunity to do this. They had Stephen Harper and Jean Charest. They met at Sussex Drive now, and it was a closed media event. You know, there's no photo ops except for them just walking in. You know, they weren't taking questions. I think this was a good opportunity for Stephen Harper to divert some of the attention over the criticisms over his cabinet, and he didn't really capitalize on it.
Well, you know, and you said earlier on that a good political party can control the headlines, but I would actually prefer to have a political party that wasn't trying to control headlines. As we've seen in so many other countries, state-run television is just not a great source for information. So, if they've kind of, dropped the ball on the initiative, I think that maybe that's partially their fault, but also I think that the media really needs to get a life.
Yeah, by state-based television, you mean like public like television, or?
Well, there are many shades of state television, state-sponsored, such as the CBC, or state-controlled, such as, we've seen in other countries.
Yeah. Well, I think actually, speaking of other countries, I think that maybe they're sort of taking a cue from the Bush administration in the U.S., because that's another administration that openly despises the media. You know, they don't talk to the media unless that they absolutely have to. And I think there's a critical difference, though, between the way they handle the media and the way that media is handled in Canada. The difference is that the Bush administration doesn't have to talk to the media to get their message out, because let's face it, they have control over, media firms that are friendly to their position. And so they can get their message out without necessarily having a press conference from in the entire press gallery. And I don't think that infrastructure exists in Canada at the Conservatives' disposal.
Well, I mean, you still have MPs on global on Sundays doing the sort of the political meet the press type thing that we see in the States. But let's face it, nothing really interesting has been going on. Parliament hasn't started up, so there's just really not a lot to talk about. So the classic argument is, well, why would you fuel stories just for the sake of fueling stories? They have come out and said we want to generate press when it's relevant and when it's sort of what they deem to be helping the cause, but not just generating press to divert people's attention off of
Right. And to clarify my position, I'm not advocating that they just create press releases for no reason, but I think specifically in the Charest case, this was something that was news. It's something that interests Canadians. It's certainly something of interest to Quebecers. They were talking about healthcare, the role of private healthcare.
But you can't have the media in every single meeting.
I'm not saying that they have to be in the meeting, but it would be nice to see, have media questions after or before the meeting, discussing what if they resolved any issues, did they come to any understanding. Now, Charest himself did have a press release after, like long after, but traditionally, like in these types of meetings, especially high profile meetings like this, you would have a press conference after with both of them.
We saw a bit of that last week with the sort of the very staged looking, new Prime Minister Harper sitting at his desk with all the, binders and legal block notepads, and talking to the press about, what's going on, with all teeth, and grins. So
yeah, well, I mean, it's not that I'm overly critical of how they're handling the press. I'm just a bit shocked because they seem to have such a good grasp on it during the campaign, and now that the campaign's over, they seem to have lost all their media savvy.
Well, I mean, you have to have media savvy during a campaign, but you don't necessarily have to have it now. I mean, you know, wait until the parliament starts up, and I think that we'll be seeing a lot more, you know, stuff in the news of substance.
Yeah. Well, anyway, while we're talking about media, another issue that's emerged is there's a couple pieces on different cabinet members besides Emerson and Forche. We'll be talking about Gordon O'Connor later. Another one is Bev Odeh, who is the heritage minister, and one of the issues, I saw two pieces actually on here. One, I believe, was in the Globe and the other was in the Ottawa Citizen. And one of the issues that she brought up was they were asking her about, okay, well, what about the CBC debate? Because we know that there are people in the Conservative Party that would like to see the CBC privatized. She didn't, you know, come out and say anything really of interest. But the one point that she did make was that they probably would be reopening this debate and looking at it again. And so I was just wondering if you had a take on, you know, the CBC, whether it's good as public or is it better as a private?
Oh, that's a difficult question. But as far as reopening the debate goes, I think that my sort of suspicion is that it's going to happen the same way that the privatization of the LCBO in Ontario, how that debate went, you know, earlier this year, last year, where the McGuinty government commissioned a study on whether it's realistic or, you know, it should be privatized, and the report found that yes, it should be, and they just decided to ignore that the findings of those report and just, you know, continue on as you know, as planned. So I think that in the CBC's case, the reason why people like the LCBO is because you know, it provides like a high quality of you know, service, like product service, and so even though you could argue that people's rights are being, you know, taken away, their right to sort of, you know, buy from, you know, a given source, you know, that this is a monopoly. In the case of the CBC, you don't have that same monopoly there, so there's not maybe as much of an argument to publicize,
yeah, to
it,
privatize
or privatize it rather, because you know, you have a lot of other strong private national media sources such as you know, CTV and Global and
CPAC for political things.
Yeah,
I think I'm a strong supporter of the CBC. I think one thing that it does is keep the other channels grounded. I think if you look at countries where they don't have a public media source, namely the United States, what you see is that there the media tends to polarize. So instead of having sort of a centralist, moderate, unbiased source, you have two sources, one that leans conservative, one that leans liberal. And I think in Canada, we've seen that, you know, we've managed to keep our media sort of centralized around unbiased reporting.
I don't find the CBC to be unbiased. I find them to sort of have, you know, a kind of a bit of a spin for everything. And, you know, I used to watch a lot of the BBC World News, you know, when I was in Germany. And there is a fine example of a national broadcasting
It's actually interesting that you bring up those two points in conjunction, because I, for one, believe that the CBC is unbiased, and it's an opinion that's not held by nearly many Canadians, and it's not just Canadians of any political stripe, and that's what's interesting about it, is if you talk to conservatives, they think the CBC is liberal, but if you talk to liberals, they think the CBC is conservative, and if you talk to people who support the NDP, they think that the CBC is at least more conservative than they are.
Well, I suppose that's one metric for unbiasedness, where everybody thinks that they're biased.
Yeah, and as far as the BBC is concerned, if you ask the Labour Party, they think the BBC is biased against them, and if you ask the Tories, they think that the BBC is biased against them. So it's sort of like this parallel, and I think that you know, we're so detached from the BBC, we can look at it objectively, whereas
when you watch the BBC, they sort of, I don't know, give you the air of just trying to present, you know, world events in a kind of a, sort of a bird's eye view of things. But when you listen to CBC, they sort of, you know, they kind of are almost, you know, in your face about, well, you know, we give you the Canadian perspective, you know, we're going to give you the sort of the spin in a Canadian way. Well, maybe that's a good thing, but I would look at that as a little bit of a bias. It's not just sort of like, well, here's what happened in Kandahar today. It's sort of like, well, here's what happened in Kandahar, and we're only telling you about it because it had to do with Canadians. There was three Canadian troops that were there that saw, you know, some shooting. So that is a bit of a distortion.
Do you think they're politically biased? I think that's sort of
difficult to say. Certainly when you read articles, your heart jumps in your mouth sometimes, and your blood boils, and you sort of write into the CBC and say, "Hey, what are you talking about?" It's difficult to say. I think that you could easily make the argument, no matter what party you're in, that they had a bias. So I'm just saying my personal preference for news, especially world news, would be something like the BBC. If you go to CNN, obviously, like, we're not kidding anyone about...
Fox News, for that matter.
Well,
they're
Fox
both, like, the opposite sides of the same spectrum. But another way of looking at how media is biased is there's a cognitive bias. There have actually been scientific studies done on it, and there's an effect that's known as the hostile media effect. And what they did was they actually took two groups of people who had different views on a given issue. One of the classic studies was, they took Israelis and Palestinians, and they showed them the exact same media clip. And they asked them, is this clip, does it favor your side or does it favor the other side? And both of them said that the clip favored the other side, that it didn't favor their side. And both of them said that they wouldn't want, if someone was neutral and they saw this clip, they would walk away with the impression that it favored the other side. And so there actually is, it's rooted in these pair of cognitive biases. It's called confirmation and disconfirmation bias. And you can look it up if you're interested in it. But there actually is a scientific studies like done on this effect that everybody thinks the media is biased
against them. Of course, there's that. But then there's also, that's the way the media is perceived, right, by the viewers. There's also the mandate of the media itself, which kind of has a sometimes at times ominous sort of element, which is, we're just trying to bring you, sensational stories. So if there isn't anything sensational, we're going to go and find something sensational. So every night we're going to bring you something, irregardless of whether it's relevant to you or not.
Or take something that isn't sensationalized.
There's a lot of issues that get, sort of pounded in the press, even for years, such as, for example, global warming, where the press plays an integral role in, sort of riling up the population about something, and the population doesn't necessarily go ahead and get themselves informed on that topic. They just rely on the press to sort of feed them that stuff. But the press loves it because it's, it's an instant story. It's a sort of like a kind of a cash cow. For them to bank on a day-to-day basis, especially when the news is slow,
Well, I'm not sure about that particular issue.
Let's talk about doomsday. The glaciers are melting.
Oh yeah, like fear-based media is a big thing. I mean, there were things like, remember like the killer bees that were supposed to come, like the killer Africanized
West Nile virus, and so I mean the list goes on.
Yeah. Anyway, so CBC, I think we're in agreement that it's a good thing in the Canadian politics, in the landscape.
I think it's it should be there. I don't think it's the kind of thing that you want to rely on exclusively. If you're a new parent and you're educating your child about the world, I think especially in the internet age, you would be well advised to say you should watch multiple news sources and try to form your own picture. Back in the day, before the internet, it was a little bit harder to do that because, you can't watch simultaneous broadcasts of the 6 o'clock news, as easily as you can just go into Google News and get all the articles, Not that Google News is also the only source, but, CBC is just sort of one element in the grander picture, and so I welcome that one element out of the whole.
Well, I'm sure we'll be hearing more discussion on this, possibly anyway, as the House resumes. Another issue that will be under Ms. Oda's portfolio is this idea of reforming the copyright, and this is sort of a fringe issue. It's an issue that both of us, I think, are interested in.
Don't even get me started.
And I think it's an issue that if you're listening to a podcast, you're certainly, sort of technically savvy enough to, like, understand that it's an issue that's important to you.
Well, yeah, digital rights management. You know, who owns content? How are people going to secure content? And should they secure content? We've seen that the music industry, the CRIAA or the RIAA, they're sort of kind of clutching desperately at the notion of a content ownership. And sort of more forward-thinking tech, minded people probably see there as being a sort of a philosophical problem with a lot of the stuff. This podcast, for example, distributed under a Creative Commons license. So, we're saying we're going to put it up on the net. We recognize the technological implications of that, that it's kind of ridiculous to sort of believe that you can control that. In any way. So, the laws are a little bit goofy, and I guess the big fear is that they're only going to get goofier and sort of more, draconian as time goes on, that they won't reflect the technological reality of how things go.
Yeah, and to give an example of that, there's a piece of legislation that didn't get passed because the government fell. It was called C60, and it's based on the WIPO treaties, which is this agreement that it was an international conference, a bunch of countries agreed on this, and it's like 10, 15 years old. And that's how they want to update our copyrights, is based on this standard that's, decades old. And just imagine like how much the internet's changed in the last 10 years. And you can also look at other countries that did implement the WIPO treaties. For example, the United States, they implemented the Digital Copyright Millennium Act under Clinton. And, there was a lot of problems with that. And, they're problems that we certainly can learn from. It seems that the industry anyway doesn't want us to learn from them. Someone else who's watching this legislation is the teachers as well in the education community. And this is the approach that I think we'll see from the new conservative government, that they're going to make sure that the teacher situation gets sorted out so that teachers can use copyrighted materials in classrooms and that type of thing. I'm not sure that they're going to take the legislation as far as I would like to see it. But one thing's for sure, I'm glad that the Liberal Heritage Minister, or the person who was in the pipeline to probably take over that seat, didn't get elected. Her name was Sam Bolte, and she was receiving campaign contributions from different industry, entertainment industry firms. And so there was sort of a backlash against her as a result of this. And this is an issue also that's dogging the current Defense Minister, Gordon O'Connor, and this idea of, he was a former lobbyist, he received campaign contributions from different, military contractors. And, there's another issue, of course, whether he can maintain, or whether there's a conflict of interest.
Well, and if you read Hugh Windsor's article in the Globe and Mail, there's nothing wrong with an ex-lobbyist as defense boss. You hear an interesting position on that.
Yeah, actually, Windsor makes a rather absurd argument, I think. Actually, let me just read it for you. He writes, It is common knowledge that Mr. O'Connor helped shape the Conservatives' defense policy, but for the conflict of interest conspiracy to hold up, Airbus would have had to predict half a decade ago that the lobbyist they had retained was A, going to run for Parliament, B, get elected to an opposition party that was going to squeak into office 3 years later, and C, be appointed Minister of Defense. It just doesn't add up, especially since at that time it appeared that Paul Martin was going to extend the Liberal dynasty for another decade, end quote. Now, this is just an absurd argument. Just because he's in conflict of interest, it doesn't mean that there was this grand conspiracy, half a decade ago that all the balls were going to line up and that they would be able to... Is that the right expression? All the balls are going to line up.
Well... I would prefer planets, but yeah, okay. I guess if you're a pool-minded person.
Anyways, the problem that I foresee with this isn't just the fact that he's an ex-lobbyist. I mean, that's one thing. Certainly, if he is a lobbyist, he has experience. And speaking of experience, he was also, he worked his way up in the Army. I think I can't remember what title he was awarded.
Brigadier General.
Yeah. And so he's certainly very competent for the job. I'm not advocating that he shouldn't have been appointed. What I am advocating is that, we should be aware of the situation. There should be a level of scrutiny given this, the past lobbyist link. But more importantly, and this is what really disturbs me, is that he really didn't stop lobbying when he entered politics. you know, he dissolved his connections formally with the group. Now, one can assume that, you know, he still has former associates at the place. You know, they're still probably his friends. But if you look at the types of questions that he was using in question period during the last parliament, where he was defense critic, Bill Graham was the defense minister, he basically used his soapbox to continue advocating on behalf of one of his former clients, which is Airbus. And I remember very vividly, and I didn't really understand the connection, but I remember the questions that he asked because they struck me as very absurd. You know, he'd get up and he'd be like, "Mr. Speaker, you know, there's a grand conspiracy against Airbus. You know, they're going to give the contract to Lockheed Martin. You know, won't the Minister of Defense do something about it?" Bill Graham would get up and he'd be like, "I don't know what this guy's talking about. You know, I haven't made that decision. I don't know where he's getting his information from. I'm happy to admit my sins after I've committed them, but, you know, let me commit them before you criticize them."
I remember
them.
That quote, yeah.
And it just seems so absurd, so it stuck out in my mind. And then once I made the connection, then I went back and I reread what he was saying. And he was essentially, you know, lobbying on Airbus's behalf, you know, as defense critic. You know, which strikes me as maybe, you know, he hasn't dissolved the connections like as solidly as I would hope.
We shall see.
But anyway, if you read the Globe and Mail editorial, he does make a good point. And that point is that as Minister of Defense, he really doesn't have the power to really influence decisions. He has lots of people working under him. There's checks and balances in place.
Under the, you know, in contrast, under the Liberals, you know, we've seen all kinds of, you know, kind of military-related scandals going on, you know, with the Sea King helicopters and, of course, the Shikudimi and, you know, the purchasing of various, you know, military equipment from various countries and sort of the harebrained...
But if you want to play that game, you could do it with the Conservatives under Maroney. So, you know, both parties, like, aren't...
I think
they don't
if you talk to the defense
clean.
Industry, people in the defense industry so far seem to have been pretty happy to hear that one of their own is going to be representing their interests in Ottawa. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, it'll keep the military-industrial complex happy anyways. Another critique that came out pertaining to defense is there were a couple studies done, I think they originated out of the U.S., saying that the defense budgets were too small, that they didn't delegate enough money. Now, I'm not an expert, I'm not an economist, I'm not sure exactly if this is credible information. But being we're talking about the U.S., another thing concerning, you know, the U.S. and Canada, of course, is the ambassador to...
Michael Wilson.
Right, to the United States. He's the new ambassador. He should
former
be...
Bay Street broker.
If you're older than us, you probably remember him from the Maroney era when he held various positions, I think Minister of Defense, or sorry, Minister of Finance, I should say. And
yes,
was,
we were admittedly too young to remember Michael Wilson. So,
but he was one of the main architects of NAFTA, and given that probably the biggest issue between the United States and Canada right now is the softwood lumber dispute, which is rooted entirely in NAFTA, you know, I think this is a really good appointee. I think, you know, he obviously understands not just the legislation itself, NAFTA, but he understands why it was implemented, and that's something that, you know, perhaps the Bush administration has become sort of removed from in the subsequent years. But he was there when it was drafted. You know, he has a very clear understanding of it. And, you know, I think he'll be able to make an impact.
Uh-huh. Well, let me take this opportunity to announce that Canada women's hockey team is up 4-0 late in the second period. And
so congratulations to the women's hockey team.
Hoorah.
And... anyway, back to politics. We talked about U.S. ambassador. We also have a new U.N. ambassador. I believe his name is John McNee, and he's replacing Alan Rock. And another appointee that Stephen Harper is going to make, and this news came out this morning, not the news that he was going to make it, but the structure in which is that he's going to pick a new justice for the Supreme Court.
All the Supreme Court. You all know and love them. 9 men and women dressed like Santa Claus.
Oh, yes. 3 of which practice civil law and 6 of which practice common law. And this, he's replacing John Major, who practices common law. What's the story anyway this morning was that they're setting up a committee, so he's going to be questioned by representatives from each party.
And, you know, this is kind of interesting after we saw the Sam Alito hearing
and
just
John
last
Roberts.
Month. But I guess the difference here is that there's actually no vote on his appointment, so it's sort of, you know, going towards the American style
Yeah, well, traditionally there is a vote. The issue here, of course, is that he has to make the decision before the House sits. And so he has to make that decision as opposed to the House voting on it. Because you
so
know,
that there is a there's sort of an urgency here to get the appointment made so that the Supreme Court can get back to work, which is sort of what they're facing right now is a heavy volume.
Right.
They're sitting right now, and so they have to like blow through all their cases, and they can't really do that, I guess.
Yeah, and thankfully, comparing it to the U.S., you know, our Supreme Court hasn't become as politicized as certainly as the U.S. court, or sorry, the confirmation hearings have been. I think this would be probably pretty low key compared to the, you know, the Roberts and the Alito hearings. Anyways, we hope to be making it out to a Supreme Court hearing sometime in the coming months, and we'll certainly bring you a report about what it's like to sit in on one of these sessions, and maybe we'll be looking at the brand new Supreme Court justice when we do it.
Well, turning now to international affairs, the cartoon controversy just refuses to let up. You know, we've kind of seen a steady flow over the last month about this, but I think that it's really started to permeate the entire globe. It's become such a phenomenon. I think we've seen it touching many people's lives, and in some case, actually taking lives. I mean, it's unfortunate to say, but you know. So I thought, in an effort to sort of, you know, get a little bit more educated on, you know, the topic of Islam, which is always, you know, I think a good thing to do for us Canadians to understand our brothers, you know, in other parts of the world. I was flipping through the channels on Saturday, and I came past CTS, which is the Crossroads Television System. It's Ontario-based Christian broadcast programming. You know, does like Seventh Heaven and like 100 Huntley Street, those kind of programs. But they offer shows in a sort of in the vein of multi-faith, what they call balance. So to kind of give, you know, a balanced perspective on faith. And so there's the show that I came across was called Islam Today, Saturdays at 3 p.m. on CTS. Very interesting television program. I have to say, I would recommend the listeners to check it out, because I guess it's not entirely Islam the way I understood it to be. And so the host of that show has some, I don't know if I would say scary ideas, but you know, I would urge the listeners to check it out, because I heard some things that kind of I found a little bit unsettling about, you know, how he wants to see Islam grow in Canada and the means by which, you know, that's going to happen. And in fact, I saw him on the news last night. There was the Queen's Park protest on Sunday afternoon regarding the comics. And he was basically, his soundbite was, you know, we will never be free until Islamic law is the law of the world. You know, this is, I mean, we just stopped talking about common law and civil law, and now we're moving on to Islamic law. I think that it's, you know, that's a point that needs to be made to some of those that are upset by this controversy, is that, you know, Islamic law is not the governing law of you know, Denmark. Ilans Posten, the newspaper that published the cartoons originally, is, you know, sort of not bound to laws of blasphemy, although, you know, it could be argued that they should be sensitive to them. And the Danish Prime Minister has come out and said that he, you know, is that he regretted the upset that it's caused. But, you know, his point, and the extension of that point made by Irshad Manji, was that there seems to be a bit of a double standard going on here. You have many Muslims around the world that feel a little bit upset by the implication that their religion and terrorism somehow are connected. You know, the point that they make, and it's entirely reasonable and defensible point, is that the actions of a few, you know, various, like, you know, things like beheadings and whatnot perpetrated in the name of Islam, that it does not reflect the religion, and that it's incorrect for people to somehow think that Islam means terrorism, right? Entirely reasonable and defensible position. However, we're seeing out of some of these protesters the same kind of fallacious reasoning that somehow the actions of Ilans Poulsen's editors and cartoonists somehow reflect Denmark as a whole. You know, burning the Danish flag, burning the Danish embassies across the Middle East. You know, this is just not in tune with the statement of, you know, don't pin terrorism on Islam. Well, you know, don't pin you know, the blasphemy, you know, the offense of that on Denmark. So what we really need to be doing is coming out in support of Denmark and of Scandinavia, who's been having a terrible time in the last little while internationally with some of what's been, you know, been going on. This has just not been correctly pinned on the country of Denmark. So, you know, hopefully we can see a little bit of more solidarity between, you know, the West on this issue, and at the same time respecting the feelings of you know, our Muslim population. So
yeah, like in North America, we tend to say, well, this is sort of Europe's problem for once. You know, we're not going, it doesn't involve us, we're not going to get involved, but it does involve us, and we've seen protests here, we've seen them in the United States, and so it's an issue that, you know, is that we have a stake in as well.
You know, they were the cartoonists, the 12 cartoonists are under police protection because their lives are in danger. You know, Vincent van Gogh's great nephew was recently murdered in cold blood because of a movie that he made about women's rights in Islam. The man that stabbed him to death, who was subsequently in a police shootout, this gentleman's argument, as criminally insane as it was that he believed he needed to do this in order to defend his religion. Well, I submit that it's a scary time when blasphemy could put you into mortal danger. So I guess we shall leave off with a quote from George Bernard Shaw. All great truths begin as blasphemies.
And that's our show for the week. We thank you for listening. Please check out our blog at phbo.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments on today's show.
Music brought to you by La Mundiale under Creative Commons licensing. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Take care. We'll see you next week.
So I guess they're up 4-1 now.
Yeah, I think they got it in the bag.
Yeah, gold medal. Excellent. Hopefully, men's team.